This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with journalist Max Blumenthal, author of the controversial book Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel.
Can the Jewish state of Israel really be democratic? What's going on inside there? Are they fair to Israeli Palestinians? And what about the occupied territories? Well, this book is an eye-opener.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
We'd like to let our New York listeners know that on Valentine's Day, this Friday, February 14th, there will be a fundraiser for Lynn Stewart. The event will be held at St. Peter's Church at 54th Street and Lexington Ave at 6 p.m. Please join us in sharing the love. And what better way than with a benefit for Lynn Stewart? We have an update on a legal challenge to the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. Last week, the Center for Constitutional Rights and many supporters packed the court in Boston as senior staff attorney Rachel Maripol asked the First Circuit Court of Appeals to strike the law down as an unconstitutional infringement on the First Amendment. ADA is a federal criminal law ushered through Congress in 2006 by powerful lobbyists for the fur, pharmaceutical, and meat industries. It criminalizes a broad range of free speech activities and has cast a chill over the animal rights community. The center filed the first civil challenge to ADA, called Bloom v. Holder, in support of five animal rights activists who have censored themselves and limited their lawful advocacy out of fear that their work could subject them to prosecution as terrorists. Last week's oral argument was the appeal after a federal court granted the government's motion to dismiss in March 2013, ruling that the plaintiffs lacked standing to bring the case. In late July 2013, the National Lawyers Guild and the ACLU filed an amicus, or friend of the court brief, in support of the appeal. We hope for a favorable ruling, and if listeners are interested in learning more about ADA and related legislation, please go to the website greenisthenewred.com, run by Will Potter, who's been a guest on Law and Disorder.
We're joined today by award-winning journalist and best-selling author Max Blumenthal. Max spent 3 years in Israel and has written the controversial book Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. In Max's book, he takes a look at the increasingly authoritarian politics in all the institutions of Israeli society, the crushing of civil liberties, the ongoing occupation of Palestinian lands, the situation in the army, in the temples, in the newspapers, in the universities. It's a rare look into Israeli society and an extraordinarily controversial book here in the United States. Max Blumenthal, author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be on with you.
Max, it's wonderful to have you. I can't tell you how we've looked forward to this. Your book, as Michael said, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, is perhaps the greatest book on, quote, Israeli democracy in a Jewish state that's ever been written, but really appreciate it.
Max, the first book you wrote, which we read and appreciated, was called Republican Gomorrah, and now you've extended your biblical reference to Goliath. Why did you call Goliath Goliath?
Well, I didn't come up with the title, actually. My first title proposition was Master Race Democracy, and they told me that they would have to sell the book in a brown paper bag if I called it that. So I next proposed Masada, which is a reference to the 2nd AD Roman fortress where Jewish fanatics committed mass suicide after slaughtering Jews who attempted to negotiate with the Roman Empire, which I thought was very reminiscent of present-day Israel, which really feels like a hermetically sealed dystopian fortress that is really imploding in a
It's a ritual to go to Israel and climb Masada.
You have your bar mitzvah there. Right. Before the occupation began, Israeli soldiers took their initiation rites at Masada. So it has.
But I've never heard the part that you just said, which is there was a group that was willing to negotiate with the Romans.
Yeah.
But,
right.
And so it does reflect some of your book.
The Jewish fanatics at Masada slaughtered the Jews who hid out at Ein Gedi and tried to cut a deal with the Roman Empire and were kind of the liberals of their time. And these fanatics were named Sicarii by Josephus, the Jewish Roman historian. And Sicarii really means terrorist in Latin. So the disciples of Meir Kahana, when they started their vigilante hit squads to attack Jewish liberals, those who they saw as, you know, sellouts, they called themselves the Sicarii.
Yeah. Okay. So that's the second title. The first title was Master Race.
Master Race Democracy.
Second Masada or something.
And so now my editors imposed Goliath on me, which is, you know, kind of fitting. And it's a good title. It's marketable. And it begins with a G, like my first book, and has, you know, biblical resonances. So it worked. And of course, Israel has always been portrayed in our media as this plucky little David surrounded by the Arab Goliath, the brown hordes. And we're supposed to sort of, you know, see our own shared values as an anti-colonial country that fought off the British Goliath. And of course, the reality is 180 degrees different. Malcolm Gladwell has a book out called David and Goliath. And I think on page 48 of this book, he has one line that says, Israel is a David, but he never backs up his claim, never supports it with anything. He is, of course, Jeffrey Goldberg's former roommate.
I didn't know that.
Well, you give us about 400 pages of backing up your claims.
And, you know, Michael says 400 pages. I just want to say, and we'll conclude with this as well, It's like eating desserts every day because it's so beautifully written and so incisive and so remarkable because it's a part that we never hear anything about in terms of what's Israeli quote democracy, and no one writes about it. They write about the occupied territories, they write about Gaza, etc. So it's,
and if you're Eric Alterman, it's like pouring salt on a wound every day. your perspective on the book is not shared by many reviewers.
We'll come to that, and it's Eric is one. Glazer was another one who was interesting in terms of that, and a little more nuanced, but still I'm very interested in discussing those criticisms with you as well.
Yeah,
but
Max,
let's start with what the book is
Max,
about.
Your book really tracks my experience having been there twice, and Michael's as well. Let me ask you, why did you dedicate the book to Akiva Orr? Who was he, and what significance did he have in your life?
I haven't had a chance to talk about him on the book tour yet. No one has noticed this, but I think some of the older people who went through who were active in the early inception of Palestine Solidarity know who he is because he's such a seminal figure. And he was really a mentor and a teacher to me who I met when on one of my first extended reporting trips. Akiva was one of the original founding members of Matzpen, which is the first anti-Zionist group to form in Israel. It's a group mainly of Israeli Jews who formed bonds of solidarity with Palestinians, opened the first contacts with the PLO after 1967, went to the West Bank and met Palestinian intellectuals and started talking about what they could do to challenge Zionism, because they saw Zionism correctly early on, before 1967, as a settler colonial movement, and saw Arab resistance to Zionism as just another form of anti-colonialism. While David Ben-Gurion was saying, no, they're just anti-Semites who oppose us because we exist. They were heavily monitored and repressed by the labor wing of the Zionist establishment, not the Likud wing. And these were basically blue-collar intellectuals, Akiva Orr, Moshe Machover, Haim Hanegbi, who is one of the original Jewish families of Hebron. They produced some of the earliest work challenging the official narrative that was handed down to Israelis on the 56 war, on the foundation of the State of Israel, at a time when information was heavily controlled. And they were barred from access to the Zionist archives that Benny Morris and Ilan Pape later accessed. So they did their work late at night in libraries and used magazines and stuff on the public material on the public record. record, and wound up kind of influencing this whole trend of post-Zionism and revision and historic revisionism. So they were really the original revisionists. They were basically intellectuals. Many of them were forced to flee into exile and go to London and challenge Zionism from the outside. But I think that they laid the foundations, especially from the Jewish perspective, of this really this burgeoning global movement of Palestine solidarity, which is, I think, one of the major social justice causes of our time. And you know, it was just incredible getting to know someone towards the end of his life, like Akiva, who I would go visit at the beach by his the moshav he lived on up by Netanya, and he would just spend hours with me explaining the whole history of the conflict. And he opened my eyes to this whole hidden history, and his hearing wasn't very good. So when I would respond and talk about things, he would basically not listen to me. And I said, Akiva, do you want to get a hearing aid or something so we can, you know, converse more freely? And he said, no, because most of what people say these days is rubbish.
Well, he and his group were very influential on me. I figured out what you figured out after the 67 war.
Yeah.
Michelle Warshawski, who was one of the younger people my age in that group, wrote a book called On the Border, his autobiography, and then he wrote Towards an Open Tomb, and that book reminded me of your book because it's just so insightful and such a scary story about just the underlying violence in that country.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about, because really every institution in Israel has been changed because of the nature of the Israeli state as an occupying force, and I wanted to ask you about that. Talk to us about some of the vignettes that so influenced you when you were over there. What did you start to learn when you spent those 3 years over there?
Matzpen warned that this would happen in 1967. They took out a full-page ad in Haaretz saying, we will become a nation of a police state and a nation of murderers. Yeshayahu Leibovich, the famous Israeli polymath, also issued similar warnings. And that's really where I come in, to show that all of their darkest prophecies have been fulfilled and realized. And I take you through Israeli society and through the key institutions of Israeli life to show how it's playing out. From my time in Jerusalem, where an anti-miscegenation movement is burgeoning in the streets of Israel and leading mob attacks on young Palestinian men who are accused of making passes at Jewish women, to the convention at the Jerusalem Ramada, where key state rabbis are sit on a panel before right-wing settlers, including settler vigilantes and leaders of this anti-miscegenation movement, to defend a book called Torat HaMelech, which is basically, according to the Israeli newspaper Ma'ariv, a guide for how and when it is permissible to kill non-Jews. It's a guide to genocide, which is being distributed into Israeli army units. You know, I take you to Beit Horon, which is an Israeli army base in the West Bank, to meet a unit of frontline border police who tell me how their fellow border police units have begun killing African refugees for sport and are never punished. And they tell me, you know, about how horrible their own lives have been as they immigrated to Israel, how mistreated they were as Mizrahi Jews, as Russian Jews, as Druze Arabs, and how the only way they could consolidate their citizenship and really earn the benefits of citizenship in Israel was to participate in these units which are lashing out at Palestinians. And the frustration they felt that this endless occupation had led them into a genocidal mentality, where one of the few volunteers for this unit told me that he wished that some strong leader would just arise from the masses and push the button that would wipe out the Palestinians once and for all. And of course, that leader is Avigdor Lieberman. He is the man who has basically promised to transfer hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. He's a rising force in Israeli society. And he sweeps, his party, Yisroel Beiteinu, sweeps high school mock elections every year. They usually finish second or third in national elections, but it's the youth whose hearts and minds they command, the next generation. And so I take you into the Knesset to meet the younger legislators and the rising stars in Lieberman's party and in Netanyahu's party, who are far to the right of Netanyahu. Netanyahu really just commands the hollow center of Israeli politics now. And you meet figures like David Rotem, who is one of the Lieberman's key deputies, crafting all of the anti-democratic laws flowing through the Knesset. And I, you know, I got to meet with Rotem at his settlement home in Efrat and listen to him tell me that the tyranny of the majority is the essence of democracy.
I love that part of the book. Your meetings with people, your courage. I mean, I've interviewed people, but when I see them, you know, I wouldn't tend to, like, challenge them the way you do. I don't know. The conversations don't start with it like that with those guys. But by the time you finish, they practically want to throw you out of the room, I think. At least some of them do.
Rotem was great because, you know, he and the other real hardcore right-wingers have this whole philosophy of being dugri, being straight. And so there's nothing I could say to shake him. And he looks at me coming in as just another pathetic Jewish liberal who doesn't really understand what it takes to prevent a second Holocaust. And that's what he said his goal was. And he said, I have a chip on my shoulder and a tick in my brain, and it's called the Holocaust, even though he himself didn't experience it. And so he looks at me as like a pathetic and weak figure, and he tells it to me straight. And no matter what I say, it doesn't shake him. It's completely different than from talking to a Republican in America, in the United States, who has to at least, you know, pander to some kind of civil rights sensibility, some kind of, you know, anti-racist sensibility, or conceal what he really thinks behind a race-blind narrative. But these people just come straight out and say it to you.
You know, Max, one thing that was interesting to me in reading the book is you talk about Lieberman, you talk about the right-wing parties, particularly on issues of everything from free speech to identity as an Israeli-Palestinian to the taking of land. But I'm trying to think of the whole political situation, because there's a lot of focus on people like Lieberman and others. But when they get these votes within the Knesset, the liberal, if there's such a thing anymore, liberal parties or Labor and certainly Kadima, the center, so-called center party, go along with a lot of it. And so I'm interested in your overview of how, I guess that's what you're writing about, of how the whole thing has been captured, if that's the right word, by these right wingers. And I may not be saying it right, but that's the impression I got.
That's pretty correct. I mean, I think that's another thing reviewers missed about my book, is that I analyze the key votes on these major anti-democratic laws going back to 2009, laws like the Nakba law, which basically criminalized observance of Palestinian dispossession in 2008, laws like the acceptance to community law, which legitimizes racial and religious discrimination for communities of under 500, these are both laws that strip off the veneer of democracy and expose apartheid for what it is. And you would think that the party of Tzipi Livni at the time, who is the leading peace negotiator right now in the Israeli government, who is the great white hope of Israeli Ashkenazi society, would have stood up against these laws, because she's always warning that there's an ill wind in Israel. You would have thought that the Labor Party, that had always advocated two states and supported the Clinton parameters, would have stood up against these laws. But in so many cases, members of these parties not only vote for the laws, they often co-sponsor them, as in the case of the acceptance to communities law, or they just simply don't vote because of the fear of backlash from their own constituents, or the fact that they really have nothing to gain from voting against these laws. It's the right wing that has captured the heart of Israeli society, because they have the dynamism. They're driving the agenda forward. And the Labor Party, at least for the last 4 years, has been under the control of someone named Shelly Yachimovich, who's just been replaced. And what she sought to do is retreat from the whole conflict, retreat from the Palestinian question, and to simply operate within the framework of domestic issues, as if such a thing exists in a country without any national legally recognized borders. And so she was fighting, you know, price hikes on cottage cheese and trying to reform the national insurance system. The Israeli liberals are basically sipping latte on the edge of a volcano, and Likud and Yisrael Beiteinu and these parties are driving the agenda forward with a very simple mantra, which is finish 48. Finish 1948.
What does that mean, finish 1948?
Well, in 1948, and actually starting in 1947, 750,000 Palestinian Arabs were expelled to allow the creation of a Jewish state with a Jewish demographic majority. But many stayed behind. 20% of the state of Israel is non-Jewish, Palestinian. and they feel very connected to the Palestinian world as a whole, not just in the West Bank and Gaza, but the Palestinian diaspora and the Arab world. Meanwhile, Israel has always sought to be what Ehud Barak defines as a villa in the jungle, a sort of European outpost, what Herzl called a rampart of civilization against barbarism. So they view Palestinian citizens of Israel increasingly as a fifth column, as a Trojan horse for the Arab world and for Arab nationalism and increasingly Islamism. And Lieberman campaigned in 2009 with a very simple slogan: no loyalty, no citizenship. If you are a Palestinian citizen of Israel and you fail to swear loyalty to the Jewish state, you should be stripped of your citizenship and expelled. And that's why Lieberman was so popular. It's why the right wing is popular, because they're promising to finish 48. And they're doing it. They have passed a law requiring loyalty oaths.
I was going to ask you, because I remember reading this. I'm trying to remember. Did they actually get that law passed?
It's now an amendment to the citizenship law. So in order to become a new citizen of Israel, you have to swear loyalty to the Jewish state. And that applies to Palestinians in East Jerusalem.
And that's not just saying swear loyalty to Israel. That's saying swear loyalty to Israel as a Jewish state.
Which is the same as asking me or you to swear loyalty to America as the white Christian state.
Right.
I don't know why more Jewish liberal Americans can't recognize that.
Just as an aside, if you'll recall yesterday in Obama's State of the Union, he said, and we will defend the Jewish state of Israel.
Yeah.
I think words to that effect.
Obama has been more extreme on this issue and on the issue of Israel than George W. Bush, by far. George W. Bush did not demand that the Palestinian Authority recognize a Jewish state under the roadmap. And George W. Bush never pledged to fight delegitimization, which is the Israel lobby's code for Palestine solidarity activism in the U.S. and BDS. So Obama's taken it a step further.
And you've painted a picture, really, of essentially these right-wingers, these, you know, basically take us, let's finish 48 people. Is there any pushback at all going on within Israel? Any at all that's significant, that's going to have an effect? Or is this just going to go out?
There's no pushback that will have an effect, but there is there's pushback. I mean, you will meet the people who are trying to push back desperately inside Jewish Israeli society on the pages of my book, because they were my roommates and my friends. They took me to the flashpoints of ethnic cleansing and conflict. They are the ones who protested the expulsions in Sheikh Jarrah in East Jerusalem. They're the ones who took me to the Palestinian villages that have had their land basically expropriated by the separation wall. They took me to the Negev Desert to witness Bedouin villages be wiped off the map by the Jewish National Fund, which was sort of a predecessor to the Proverb Plan, which, you know, was basically a mass expulsion plan of indigenous Bedouins. And their numbers are like less than 700. I mean, they command a massive presence in Israeli society. These are the leftists.
I mean, 700? Is that the number you gave
me? I would
me?
Number 700 or less active left-wingers who are,
wow,
you know, leveling their bodies against the occupation and apartheid. And many of them revolve around Anarchists Against the Wall, this group which is heavily inspired by Matzpen, which we discussed before. They're not really anarchists in any ideological sense. It's more a sensibility. Uri Gordon, who's one of the founders of this group, of the original members, said, we could have called ourselves Satanists Against the Wall, but we just called ourselves Anarchists Against the Wall because of the transgressive impact of the term. So anyone can be a part of it, and there's no official membership. And what they do is basically go out and try to support Palestinians protesting the wall, protesting dispossession, and to bear witness. They would take me to the military courts where Palestinian children who'd been ripped out of their beds by soldiers at night and taken to a dark cell were being arraigned and placed on trial. And they helped me translate the proceedings and understand what was going on. So these people were really helpful to me. They're helpful to diplomats. They are making an impact. But what you see increasingly among them is, number one, massive repression. They are, of course, not experiencing the kind of repression that Palestinian activists, including inside 48 Israel, experience. But they are increasingly being interrogated by the Shin Bet. They know they're being watched. They're being held at airports and shaken down My friend Yonatan Shapira, who's a former combat pilot who has now become an activist for the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, was interrogated after returning from a trip to Poland, where he went to the last remaining wall of the Warsaw Ghetto. You know, his family are Polish Holocaust survivors and victims, and he spray painted "Free Gaza" on this wall and was interrogated for this act that made national news in Israel. And the Shin Bet officer, her name is Rona, she interrogates all the leftists, basically kind of calls them for tea, as, you know, the Chinese state security does with Chinese dissidents. She said, "We are going to pass a law that will criminalize what you did." It's basically like, we have a future crime unit. Right. And I interview the legislator who's introducing this law. The law will mete out 2-year jail sentences for any Israeli citizen who calls for a boycott of the state of Israel. And the law actually did pass, but in a different form, which allows settlers to sue fellow Israelis who they believe are harming their businesses without any evidence. So that, you know, warning by this future crime unit from a Philip Dick novel came to pass. And so the writing's on the wall for these activists that there is very little room for them left in Israeli society. Smolenim, or leftists, is one of the biggest insults in Israeli society. And so what they've done is called to the outside. They're calling to us. They're forming, organized around the Boycott From Within committee, and they're signing letters asking performers not to come to Israel. They're signing letters calling on Americans to boycott their country. And that is really where the activism of radical left-wing Israelis is going. And you have to note that these are people who come from the ranks of the Ashkenazi elite, like Yonatan, who comes from a military family. These are people like Menachem Begin's grandson. I mean, these are people who would have been the leaders of their society if their society had gone a different direction.
One of the things that I think a lot of Americans don't know about is about the taking of the land. And yes, we all know a lot about the occupied territories and taking the land there, but within Israel itself. And I think one of the things your book brings out is about the Jewish National Fund role and the Jewish Agency role. And can you describe that for us and what that's meant for people who have, whether it's farms in Israel itself?
The Jewish National Fund is the premier Jewish charity in the world. And I think, you know, anyone who is of, you know, my grandparents' generation remembers the little, are they the little blue boxes?
We had one at my Sunday school or Saturday school, whatever I went to.
And it didn't
have much of an effect on you.
Well, when I was a kid at Temple Sinai in Washington, we had that as well. And I donated a tree because I had this little dog who would follow me home from school, and we adopted him. And he was my friend, and he got run over by a car, and I was very broke up about it. So I donated a tree in Israel and named it after him. And so it was really painful for me when I learned that the Jewish National Fund was also the premier paragovernmental organization in Israel carrying out ethnic cleansing and committing crimes against humanity. And I witnessed this ethnic cleansing and wrote about it in my book, Goliath, when I visited the unrecognized Bedouin village of Al-Araqib in the Negev Desert inside Israel. I mean, these are Israeli citizens, and this village has been destroyed 54 times by bulldozers emblazoned with the logo of the Jewish National Fund. The whole purpose of this destruction, this campaign of calculated destruction, is to build a Jewish National Fund forest on the ruins of this village and house Jews-only, very small Jews-only communities. The forest is being funded by an evangelical end times network in the UK called God TV. And I went on the God TV's website after seeing a sign by Al-Araqib that read to soon to be the future home of God TV Forest. And I found Rory Alec, the founder of this end times network, standing over some saplings in the Negev Desert, declaring that he was beautifying the land for the return of the Messiah. And he's partnering directly with the Jewish National Fund, which, you know, Jewish kids are funding in their Hebrew schools, just like I did. So this was really remarkable. But then, you know, you go back into the whole history of the Jewish National Fund, and they are the organization which is driving the campaign of what the Israeli government calls Judaization. And they've been doing so since their inception at the turn of the century, their foundation by Theodor Herzl. They their director, Yosef Weitz, during the final phases of the 1948 war, was on the transfer committee headed by David Ben-Gurion, planning which, organizing ethnic cleansing and deciding which Palestinian villages would be wiped off the map and which and who could stay. So this organization has been involved from the beginning in Judaization, which simply means replacing Palestinian Arabs with Jewish Israelis. It's classic textbook settler colonialism, funded to the tune of tens of millions of dollars each year.
We're speaking with Max Blumenthal, the author of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And we'll be right back after this break.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with Max Blumenthal, the author of this important book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel.
You know, one interesting aspect of the book is, of course, how people, as a young Jewish kid, were shown certain people were heroes in my life around Palestine and Israel, Israel in particular. Moshe Dayan being one, the one-eyed general, I think later became an archaeologist. And you always see these heroic pictures of him, and he's walking around, and, you know, relatives have met the guy, etc. You do write about Moshe Dayan, particularly the killings that took place at Khan Yunis and Rafah. And, of course, it gives you a very different picture of Moshe Dayan. But there's also something that you quote Moshe Dayan as saying that really gets to the heart of it and actually is truth-telling in a certain way. And why don't you talk about that a little bit? Because it really does say they knew what they were doing, they're doing it on purpose, and in a sense, they don't care.
Yeah. Yeah, and just to talk about those massacres during the 56 war when Israel momentarily occupied the Gaza Strip, they wanted to occupy the Gaza Strip well before 67. It wasn't some accident, as Gershon Gorenberg says. But I actually had to turn to a comic book to really get the oral testimonies from that wave of killings where hundreds of men were lined up against walls and shot in the back of their heads, execution style, simply for being of military age by Israeli soldiers.
1956, right?
Yeah, I had to turn to the work of Joe Sacco, the comic book artist, who actually happens to be a brilliant journalist and historian, because this massacre had been buried and basically disappeared from our history. And we know why. But, you know, around this time in 56, Moshe Dayan delivered an address to the nation, which I consider to be one of the three most important documents of Zionism, next to the Iron Wall, which is Jabotinsky's 1923 essay, and probably Herzl's Alte Neuland. But Dayan was responding to the killing of a couple in a new kibbutz implanted on the border of the Gaza Strip by Palestinian fedayeen. These kibbutzim were planted there to basically hold the borders of the new Jewish state against the refugees who had been expelled. And so they served a military function. And the fedayeen were making incursions in order to push back the kibbutzim because they recognized that this was going to set the future borders. And so Dayan was deeply moved by this killing of this couple who were about to get married, and he delivered an address that resonated throughout the nation. And he was addressing the people in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and he basically said, we cannot hope to plant a tree or build a house without the steel helmet or the cannon. Then he acknowledged, the Palestinians have every right to hate us. We have expelled them, we've taken their homes, and they're seething with hatred behind the heavy gates of Gaza. Those are his words. And, you know, foreshadowing the siege of Gaza, which exists today. So he basically freely admitted that Israel was a settler colonial movement which could never have any accommodation with Palestinian Arabs and which needed to secure its place with constant, unrelenting violence, basically updating Jabotinsky's Iron Wall. And by the way, Ari Shavit, in his new book, My Promised Land, calls this speech by Dayan brilliant and endorses it. But this really exposes the whole philosophy and psychology of Israel as a Jewish state and its relationship to Palestinians. And it's what made, I think, it's part of what made Dayan such a seminal figure, is that he would openly make such a declaration.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned the Avi Shavit,
mention,
because I didn't read the book yet, but I read the New Yorker piece on the destruction of Lydda, which is happened in 48. And he after goes through the entire tragedy of Lydda and how the Palestinians are kicked out and put on a, you know, exiled out, and they die on the way, children and everything else. And you expect a conclusion that says, well, maybe this was bad, or maybe we shouldn't have done this. In the end, he said, this was necessary to create Israel. And that's Avi Shavit saying that, and now you have Dayan saying that. And now you have people like the New York Times pushing that Avi Shavit book. And what it got to me, I read the, I'm sure you looked at it, the Peter Bienert article in the New York Review of Books, how people only in Israel knew what they were doing and what Palestinian life was like, et cetera, et cetera. They might change. Right. I just think that's utter junk. They know. They know.
Well, Bienert's never done any reporting from there. So Ari Shavit's book has been everywhere, My Promised Land. You know, he does arrive at a point in his book that I agree with, and that is important, and it's about 1948, which is that 1948, not 1967, is the source of Palestinian grievances, and it was for Palestinians a massive act of ethnic cleansing and a crime, and he tracks it by following a unit in Lydda. Of course, no one writes about the fact that his chapter on the ethnic cleansing of Lydda was preceded by a chapter on how the Palestinian national movement was controlled by Nazi Germany during the late 30s and early 40s, and how it was planning to carry out on behalf of Hitler a genocide of Jews in historic Palestine, for which there is no historical basis. And of course, he makes no mention of the fact that the Zionist movement was openly negotiating with Nazi Germany. It completely contradicts all the history that Tom Segev has produced on Israel and the Holocaust. It completely contradicts everything we know. And there are no footnotes or citations or endnotes in the entire book. It's scandalous. But what's most scandalous is that, as you said, Michael, he comes to the conclusion, the opposite conclusion of me about 48, which I consider to be a crime that needs to be prosecuted and reversed, just like any act of ethnic cleansing, he concludes that it needed to happen and should be consolidated because without the Nakba, this massive act of ethnic cleansing, he could not have been born. That's actually what he says. And he's been feted and celebrated by a who's who of Jewish American liberals. So this is really just a tragic, even damning commentary on the state of Jewish American liberalism, that someone like Ari Shavit would be celebrated when he is an open apologist for ethnic cleansing. I mean, would some Serbian nationalist be celebrated for apologizing for Milosevic? I don't think so.
Max, I found it like just shocking, and I understand that. And I think your point that it's conceivable that book, not that it came out then, and et cetera, but the way it's been reviewed, front page New York Times book review, at the same time as your book, without a review of your book, is a way of basically trying to put your book into a dustbin in some way and make really go with what the politics are in this country about Palestine and Israel.
No, the New York Times just reviewed a new book by a Israeli rabbi, an American Israeli rabbi, and it contains the word Jew 6 million times. That's the entire content of the book.
I saw it.
Jew 6 million times. So I realized what I had to do to get my book reviewed is, you know, I should have written the phrase Jewish and Democratic 7 million times for each Palestinian refugee. And maybe I could have gotten, well, I don't think it would have been in there.
So, Max, we were talking about Avi Shavit's book, but that brings us really into the question of the reception of your book.
Yeah.
And you obviously, as the writer in an important book like this, we would all want to see it get out there. But there's been a lot of criticisms, both within The Nation, which was your actual publisher, by Eric Alterman. There's been an interesting, some of the criticisms were like just completely off the wall. I mean, Eric Alterman's, you know, your use of terms, which is, I found interesting. People complain that you use terms having to do with the Nazis. And then when I started reading the book, all of that, at least all that I saw, came out of the mouths of Israelis themselves. Yep. They use the word fascism to describe their own, what they're doing. I mean, this is the descriptions they give, people within Israel. So let's address that part, and then I want to go to some other critiques of that people have made.
Well, I also showed up as number 9 on the Simon Wiesenthal Center's list of anti-Israel anti-Semites, and they called me an anti-Semitic Jew, not even a self-hating Jew, but a Jew who hates Jews, which is the new thing.
Your best tweet back, hey guys, you said, next year I can do better.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I am, as an American Jew, I strive to be at the top of my field, so I'm hoping to make it number one. I got stiff competition there because Ayatollah Khomeini was number one. I was tied with Alice Walker, by the way, and right behind European sports venues, those anti-Semitic stadiums. But one of the things that they said about me or that went into my dossier was that I quoted people calling Israeli soldiers Judeo-Nazis. But the person that I quoted was Yeshayahu Leibovich, who is, you know, any Israeli, at least older Jewish Israeli, will know who he is. I mean, he's one of the greatest religious thinkers in Jewish Israeli history. He's ranked as one of the top 100 Israelis of all time in a poll, a popular poll by Israelis. He even has now a street named after him in Israel. He was stripped of the Israel Prize for calling Israeli assassination squads Judeo-Nazis, but he was also nominated for it. And this was, you know, this is part of the language that Israelis use because their frame of reference for the ultimate evil is the Holocaust and Nazi Germany. So they frequently use the term fascism. And, you know, this is just a way of avoiding the actual substance of my book, is to talk about the titles of chapters. And I actually think that there was that those who wanted to damn my book the most were literally afraid to open the pages and read it because of the truth that they would uncover there, that it was like this black box they couldn't open. And so they couldn't go beyond the chapter titles. It's why Eric Alterman in The Nation got so much wrong, because his head was spinning and he, you know, he was verklempt. He couldn't take what I was showing him. Yeah. And so there hasn't been yet a critical review of my book or an attack on the book that has engaged the actual substance of the book or the facts contained in it.
Yeah, as you have said, I've heard you say it before, and you said it here again, no one has pointed to any facts that are wrong. And the book is very, very factual. And I want to go back to the critiques, but before that, when I first started the book, you know, it's this big, thick book, but it's in many chapters, so it's quite easy to read, quite well written. Again, we're interviewing Max Blumenthal on his new book, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. But you read the first three pages, which is about Gaza. And already, that's more information than anybody in the United States knows about Gaza. So everybody thinks, oh, well, Hamas are throwing rockets into Israel and to Sderot and everything. But you start off by saying on November 5th, the Israelis made a raid into Gaza, captured or killed six Hamas people. And that was the beginning of the break of the ceasefire. But you think anybody in this country knows that? But so I just want, that's just an indication to me of how important this book is for people getting the facts of what's really going on.
Well, I explain what Gaza is. I mean, it is basically a dystopian panopticon, a ghetto for 80% of refugees. 80% of those who live in the Gaza Strip used to live in what is now Israel, or their parents or grandparents lived there, and they can't return because they're not Jewish. That's why there is a conflict and a crisis, and they are held there forever. The plan is to hold them there forever without allowing them to have a state with any connection to the outside world, and without allowing them to have any rights, holding them in a situation where Israeli administrators control their daily calorie count. They literally count the calories for each Gazan resident with complex mathematical formulas to ensure, as Dove Weissglass, the former aide to Ehud Olmert and Ariel Sharon, said, so that they won't starve, but they'll be kept on a diet. It's a very anachronistic, unusual situation that is tolerated by the international community, by the world. John Kerry, in presenting his framework agreement, hasn't mentioned the Gaza Strip once. It's not part of the Palestinian state that he seeks to create. Barack Obama has never, ever challenged the idea of holding 1.8 million people under siege because they possess the wrong ethnicity. And so I think the Gaza Strip should really be at the front of our concerns on this entire issue. And we have to ask ourselves, if this is permissible, if these people can be held forever in a ghetto and not be allowed out without special permission, and no one can get in except through tunnels. I've been blocked from getting in, for example. Then what else is permissible? What else can they do? What else can be done? Who else can be excluded? Who else can be ghettoized? Who's going to say something? And that's really what I think is one of the key issues inspiring the BDS movement, which is an end around for people who feel betrayed by Washington and betrayed by their governments when a situation like this is taking place and expanding, as Jeff Halper from the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolition says, into a global Gaza, where the techniques that have been used to control people in the Gaza Strip are literally being exported because Israel is the only country that has the ability to basically lab test such a regime of control and domination. And that's very appealing to people in the United States, to the Department of Homeland Security, to private prison companies like CCA, who seek to control other groups of people who are being actively excluded from our society.
I think that is one of the reasons you probably open with Gaza, because it is really emblematic of what you see as the problem.
Yeah, and I opened with it because it was the source of my outrage. It's what inspired me to do this book, was just sitting there in front of my laptop during Operation Cast Lead in late 2008 and watching the Al Jazeera live stream, because we couldn't get any coverage in our media, and seeing the opening attack, the opening volley of Israel's attack on the Gaza Strip, in which F-16s fired precision missiles at a graduation ceremony of police officers in the Gaza Strip and killed, I think, 60 cops and wounded hundreds of others. And I saw the images of these cops trying to clean human organs and body parts off the ground of their comrades who had just graduated. And it shocked me so much. And I was watching, so I continued watching this over the coming days. And I knew Barack Obama, who had just been elected, and who was just being celebrated as if he was the baby Jesus by all these liberals and leftists I knew, was being briefed on this attack and said nothing about it. And I watched as Al Franken, who had just been elected to the Senate, went and spoke out in favor of the attack on it at a pro-Israel rally alongside his opponent, Norm Coleman. And I went to a rally in Midtown, New York, where David Paterson, then the governor, and Chuck Schumer stood in front of a crowd that was holding a sign in the front row, a huge sign that said Islam is a death cult, and declared their support for this attack and said what other country would be as humanitarian as Israel. And it just... it shocked me so much that I really decided I am going to invest all the royalties from Republican Gomorrah and whatever advance I have left into this new project to show what this attack is doing, not only to Palestinians, but to Jewish Israelis, to spend as long as it takes inside Israel-Palestine to get a full picture. And that's really
what I've done. You spent 3 years in there, right? I mean,
well, I've spent 4 or 5 years writing the book and about a year on the ground.
We have a couple of concluding questions. One of them, I want to go back briefly to some of the critiques. And the main one that I've seen from Jeremy Slater and some others is, well, look, at what we have to do in America, in the U.S., is convince, really, Zionists about changing the policy, because that way the U.S. can put pressure on Israel, and then we'll be able to get policy change, because the U.S. is the biggest, by far, donor to Israel and couldn't probably survive without it. And they said the problem with Max's book, and I've heard this from a couple of people, is that it's too harsh. It doesn't give the other side. It's not going to really convince people. And if we need a book that's going to convince people, this one isn't going to do it. Quoting what I hear, not what I think, obviously. What's your response to that?
Well, Israel is engaged in a project of settler colonialism, and most Jewish Israelis have been indoctrinated to believe that settler colonialism is the basis of what Israel is, which is why when we are accused of – it's why we are accused of trying to destroy Israel, because we're trying to remove them of that system and normalize their presence. And so no settler colonial society or state has ever given up their campaign of dispossession, militarization, without massive external pressure. South Africa didn't do it. France didn't do it. France was more of a traditional colonial, was engaged in a traditional form of colonialism, but you get the point. And then the states that weren't pressured sufficiently completed their project. The United States placed the Native Americans on reservations and they're stuck there. New Zealand, I mean, they've doomed the Maori people. And so the question is, what are you going to do after 50 years of occupation, after 60 years of ongoing dispossession, where a day hasn't passed without ethnic cleansing occurring before our eyes? Are you going to continue to appeal to people in a society that is under the control of a permanent right-wing majority? And if you're going to do so, I think that you're perpetuating the status quo, because they are not going to turn away from this project. There is no element within the Zionist spectrum in Israel. The Zionist
here in the U.S. in terms of your book?
Well, I'm getting to that.
Oh, sorry.
Well,
okay.
The point I wanted to make is, you know, I think that it's clear there's no element within the Zionist spectrum in Israel which is capable of unraveling this project of occupation and dispossession, or which has any serious will to. The people who are popular in Israel, the politicians, as I said at the beginning of this interview, are those who want to finish 48 and consolidate the ethnically pure state that Herzl outlined in his original work. That's the project. That's the plan. If you're against it, you have to stop trying to appeal to people on the inside and force them to give it up.
And the book, I want to again recommend it. It's incredible. Max Blumenthal, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Max, I know how much work you did on it, years and years, and I hope that you're going on the road will eventually give it the reception it really deserves and make the changes that we all want.
Thanks so much, Michael.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.